Welcome. My name is Mark Depew. I'm the Director of Oral History with the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library. Today is Monday, July 21st, 2014, and today I'm with Gary Price. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning.
We're going to be talking to Gary a couple sessions at least. Gary's had a long career in the United States Marine Corps as an aviator. Today's focus is going to be all about your experiences in Vietnam, but you didn't really spend much time in Vietnam itself.
No.
Fascinating story, though, because you were there at the end, and that's where we're going to end up. But let's start at the beginning of your story, Gary, and tell me a little bit about when and where you were born.
Well, I was born in Fresno, California, and I was raised in California, actually Northern California, Sonora, northern part, Stanislaus County. Grew up there. Dad was a teacher in high school, so you have those challenges where your dad's a teacher and you're a student, and so the kids always made fun of you a lot of times. But other than that, grew up with the desire to fly. My dad got me in a line control model airplanes, and that kind of put the bug into me. Sunday after church, we'd go to the airports and watch airplanes take off and land for hours, bring a lunch and something. That's what we did, and that was how we entertained ourselves from Sundays. He had that same desire and put the bug into me, and so over the time, I end up wanting to fly. And so,
what was your birthday again?
October 7th, 1948.
Was your dad a World War II veteran?
No, he was not. He was not a veteran at all. In fact, the only veterans in my family was my uncle, who was a World War II veteran, MP, so he was like my favorite uncle. He always had stories, see stories about what he did and what he didn't do. And of course, when I got in the Marine Corps, it became a two-way. We started sharing stories about what we'd done and where we're going. But my dad was not a veteran, and he did not discourage me, did not encourage me, just, pushed me in the direction I want to go.
What kind of, what subject was your dad teaching?
Actually, he taught mechanical drawing, and he was studying to be a school psychologist on the side, so he ended up getting his master's and becoming the school psychologist with it before I graduated. So I had one class with him. I actually got an A in it. Everybody thought I was, had some partiality going on, but I did, and I worked hard because I had to. My dad was a teacher there, and I couldn't let him down. So anyway, but mechanical drawing, and that was mainly his he did a little coaching on the side in tennis when he had a chance.
So the class you took was a mechanical drawing class?
Yes, sir.
Okay. How about your mother? Tell me a little bit about your mother.
We always teased my mom that she learned to talk and talk a lot when she was a telephone operator. Back in the days when you actually pull the plug out and plug them in, that's when she became a telephone operator. She did that because my dad went back to college to get his teaching credentials, or at least his graduate degree. And so mom actually put us, she brought home the money, but she did it talking on the telephone, being a telephone operator. So she talked, and we always teased her even today that she learned her gift of gab anytime, anywhere, for how long as you want to talk, by starting off with a telephone operator. But she did that for 20 years. 20 years in a telephone AT&T company. And we finally moved to Northern California, and she worked for AT&T as a front office lady, and she collected the bills and so forth. But she retired.
So which one of your parents do you take after, Gary?
I don't know. I probably a little bit of both. Right now, my dad passed away about 7-8 years ago, and he left the family for a while, so we got closer to my mom's side. And so probably my mom in that regard. But she's been my spiritual mentor in life, as well as my, I call her every day when I go home from work, just to say hi and what's going on.
Do you lack for words yourself?
Probably not.
Good.
So I can talk.
Where did you move to in Northern California?
A town called Sonora. It's an old Sonora, Columbia, Twain Hart, or a kind of old gold rush towns. In fact, the Sonora Creek that ran through the town, I used to spend time when I had a little bit off from high school going down and panning for gold. And you always found gold. I mean, it was everywhere. It wasn't a whole lot. But you're paying for gold, and you get color, as they call it, and you can, if you did it long enough, you can get an ounce out of it. But back then, in the 60s, $35 an ounce is what the gold was going for, which is not a whole lot, but then it was. And we found some dirt at one place, and I worked at the airport loading and mixing fire retardant for these what we call borate planes, TBMs and PBYs, and we spent hours doing nothing, waiting for the fire. So we would sneak off at night and get this dirt and come back and we pan this dirt over a faucet. We got all kinds of gold. We really did. We went to the jewelry stores in the local areas and sold to them nuggets, you know, the size of your little finger. We got a lot of gold. So the gold rush is, the gold is still there. It's just a matter of knowing where to get it and how to get it.
This is stuff you're doing in high school?
Yeah, high school.
What was it like thinking back, you know, we're roughly in the same generation. A lot of people get very nostalgic about growing up during those years. Are those good years to be growing up in Sonora?
I thought so. I mean, it wasn't uncommon to see someone walking down the street, cowboy boots, cats, wearing a six gun on the side of the hip. You know, that's kind of the culture we had. It was a disruption of our what we thought was right when the long hair hippie movement came in, Haight-Ashbury in the late 60 time frame. And so we always harassed those kids that came up just because we could, you know, because we didn't like what they stood for. And but that time frame, well, of course, up there it was the country, the outdoors. Rodeo was the biggest thing in town, and riding horses. My sister had 6-7 horses, and so that was the time frame we spent. I did a lot of hunting, I did a lot of fishing. And a lot of people did the same thing in my generation, so at least in that area. So I thought it was a good life. It was a wholesome life. And my dad was a school teacher, and mom worked in the town, so we were involved community-wise, too.
Did you live on a farm?
We lived on 10 acres of land. It wasn't a farm. Dad tried to make it a farm, an apple farm, but the deers kept eating all the apples. And so we didn't raise anything to eat, basically, that much. But we had all kinds of apple trees, and they were around the house and so forth. But no, we lived out in the country, next to a horse ranch, and I shot my deer in the backyard. I do a quail hunt in the backyard, and so it was one of those places where it was still isolated, and you could do a lot of things. Real close to our house was this big granite boulder, and it was covered with dirt, but when it rained real hard, it would open up some holes. And if you clean the holes out, you found out that this was a spot where the Indians were grinding their acorns, and they were making, you know, you can almost lay out the whole area, a hole here, a small hole there, where we figured they were Indians would come up from the creek, because behind our house there was a burial ground, and every year tulips would come up where the graves were at. Now, they'd been robbed, but the tulips kept coming up every year, about 5 or 6 of them up there. So the Miwok Indians wasn't too far from where we're at, so we figured the Miwok Indians, you know, kind of moved around, used this big old granite boulder to mush up the, you know, the acorns and make whatever they wanted to make there. The creek was close by, so they probably had water for that. So it was kind of a nice area. We would walk around, find Indian arrowheads sometimes in our land, and so... But that's kind of what we did. My kids came up there, and we would build tree houses, and so it was kind of a, you know, back to nature trip when I came home.
Well, it sounds like a great place for a kid with an imagination.
You had to have imagination, because there wasn't much else to do. You can get out there and, you know, get back, and you're isolated somewhat. We had a half-mile dirt road to get to the main road from where we lived. And so we came home, you know, when we got the cars and got older, probably very little as possible, because once we got home, we kind of stayed there.
What year did you graduate from high school?
In 1966.
And you went to public school, apparently?
I did.
Any other extracurricular activities?
That time, no. Just in school, just sports. I played football, wrestled, and tennis, and...
What did you think you wanted to do when you graduated?
I wanted to be a physical education coach. And I went to junior college Modesto, which was a couple hours away, and I majored in physical education. That was my desire. And I thought I was pretty good at math, so I was going to go with a math minor, because that was a little bit different from the normal PE-type majors, being history or English. And at that time, they didn't appeal to me as much. And I thought I had a chance maybe have that niche with the math. Math, I did okay. I graduated from junior college, but I just lost the motivation to kind of really jump into the two-year, four-year element. Of course, Vietnam was coming up or had been around, and I went to school to go to school because most of my friends jumped in the National Guard to not get drafted, and I didn't think much about it. We went down and watched Green Beret when it first came out, about 9 or 10 of us, and everybody but Jim Podesta and I, they all joined up in the Army. And the next day he signed up. That's how motivated you were sometimes in watching these movies. And they joined up to go in the Army. A lot of my friends went to National Guard. I just went to college, you know.
Before we get beyond the high school and the college years, do you remember the Cuban Missile Crisis at all? Did you pay attention to that?
No.
I think you probably remember this one, though. JFK assassination, 1963, yeah. November of 63.
Yeah.
What do you remember about that event?
To be honest, not a whole lot that happened. It was a tragedy. I know the school shut down in that regard. We didn't, you know, at the time, people had speculations, you know, they had theories about what happened, what was going to happen. And of course, with the next, two, 3 weeks, we had the other Kennedy shot as well, so it became pretty tragic event.
Well, we had the assassin who was killed, yeah. Right afterwards. Yeah.
Right.
You mentioned already that you always had this interest in flying. So yeah. I'm surprised that you weren't interested in joining the military right out of high school.
No, I didn't. I don't know why. I think, one, because I didn't have a college degree at the time. And I didn't want to fly helicopters. That wasn't my desire at the time. I want to fly jets, just because that was seemed to be the thing. And that required a college degree. And I didn't have one. And so my mom knew I wanted to fly. And they were in San Francisco on a conference, a governmental type of conference. And my dad was, I guess, doing what he had to do. My mom was walking around looking in the hallways. And they had all these employment opportunities, and they had all four services there.
When was this? Do you remember the year?
It had to be in the 71 time frame. 71, maybe late 70, November time frame, because I actually signed up in May of 71, so it wasn't too far before that. Because she was down there, and the story goes, as she tells him, that she went down to the different recruiters saying, my son want to fly jets, but he hadn't got a college degree. And so the Air Force says, well, you need a college degree. We can't help you. And so she goes to the Navy, can't help you. The Army says, well, I can fly helicopters, but he didn't want to fly helicopters, she said. So she gets to the Marine Corps, and a custody old gunnery sergeant says, we got the program for your son. Just sign right here, and we'll sign him up. And so I get a phone call Monday. It was over the weekend, Monday. Say, I'm scheduled for a physical for Oakland Naval Air Station on a certain date. And I was a little taken back, so I said, well, I don't think, who signed me up? Well, a lady named Dorothy Price. Oh, geez, that's my mom. So I said, let me call you back. So I called my mom. She said, well, Gary, you want to fly? Here's an opportunity to fly jets, be an officer in whole works. And I said, okay, maybe this was my destiny. I don't know. So I ended up calling back, scheduled the physical. I passed a physical. I took the written test for aviation. I passed all that. So next thing it was, no, I raised my hand in May of 71. In August of 71, my dad never been to the airports and never flown an airline. So he takes me to San Francisco to fly me to OCS, Officer Candidate School in Quantico. And of course, we were all a little bit nervous. I never flown before. And I get on the airlines, and I'm flying, and of course, the stewardess talk about your travels and a few things, and next thing I remember hearing, he says, well, we'll be landing in LaGuardia, New York. I'm thinking, no, I'm not supposed to go there. I'm supposed to go to Washington, D.C., and found out that I was on the wrong airlines. And of course, you think, how can that happen? Well, it happened. We're on the wrong airlines, so now I got to New York. I had to go another place to get another flight back to Washington, D.C., So that started my military career. I already had a wrong flight, getting very late. I was one of the last buses, in fact, the last bus to leave Washington, D.C. area airport to go to Quantico. And that's kind of how it started. But
I'm interested in your timeline, because you graduated from high school in 66. Did you complete an associate's degree in 68?
No. No, I quit school. And I went back after about one semester and got the last classes I needed to graduate. So I actually probably graduated in 69.
Okay. But that's about the time that the draft is going hot and heavy. And you obviously are in good shape physically. There's nothing that would prevent you from being drafted.
That's right.
So how was it that you were able to avoid the military until 71?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I had my draft card was 1A. I didn't avoid it. I was just waiting to be called, and I didn't get called, and I ended up joining the Marine Corps, and obviously that eliminated being drafted.
I know. I think it was December of '69 that they changed the draft system and went to the lottery, and that started in 1970. Do you remember what your number was?
I do not.
Fairly high. High enough that they weren't interested in you?
It may be in the 1200 category.
Okay.
If that makes any sense.
I
don't know. Actually, I didn't really care. I mean, if my call, my number was called, I was going to go. It was just one of those things where, you know, I got myself out of high school. I mean, out of college. Now I'm 1A. Now the lottery is coming around. And I really didn't, you know, I said, okay, I wasn't going to voluntarily join for that reason. But I wasn't going to, you know, run to Canada either if I got called in to go. Fortunately, things worked out to where I just signed up the Marine Corps before all that happened.
Okay. Let's talk about your experiences at Quantico.
Okay.
Because my understanding is they're not necessarily gentle to the young officer candidates there.
No, they're not. It's 12 weeks of course officer candidate school. And it's just like boot camp at Paris Island, you know, San Diego. Probably not as, it's not as long, obviously. But you had to be physically fit. And that was one of the main points that I remember, because I could do 20 pull-ups and I could do 100 sit-ups in 2 minutes. And the max run was 18, and I was in that 21, 20 and a half category. So I was probably in the top third, if not top fourth, of my class. And the class was about 200 plus the company, about 200 Marines. And so I was singled out a lot of times to make up a pull-up bar chart. We had a pull-up bar in a squad bay, open squad bay, and I had to make sure everybody signed off doing their pull-ups at night, because I could do pull-ups and nobody else could. 3 was minimum to pass, and most were in that 5 and 6 category. And so, but that's what I remember. We did a lot of hikes, a lot of physical fitness, 3-mile runs and hikes with packs and so forth. And we end up doing a lot of little war gamings, hiking 20 miles and then bivouac, dig holes, and play the war games a little bit and hike back.
I know at present, if you don't have a college degree, you're not going to get a commission of any type. Obviously, the rules were different at that time.
Well, evidently, when my mom saw this recruiter in San Francisco, he was mentioning a program that the Marine Corps just opened up for a short time. Post-Vietnam, they were, I guess, the rift of aviators as well as officers in general was occurring. And, well, that was a reason, I don't know. But they had a window where you had to be a graduate of 2-year college and transferable to a 4-year college and accepted as a junior, which I had that. That's as far as I got. And based on that, they would send me to Officer Candidate School, and if I qualified for aviation, send me right to Pensacola. And that's the program I was in. And as I got to Quantico, I found out in my 200-plus company, there were 6 of us in that program.
6 of you who didn't have college degrees?
Yeah.
Well, not necessarily a group that you want to belong to, was it?
Well, at the time, we didn't care, you know. We were fellow Marines, you know. We were candidates at that time.
Crawling around in the mud, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference.
It doesn't make a difference. The only bad thing or good thing is that because most of us, it was about half of us were for an aviation Jim, Sakura, Mike, about five of us were for aviation. And we went straight to Pensacola and start training. Now, every other Marine has to go to training basic school, which is a six-month school. And there's where you learn to be what they call a rifleman. Every Marine's a rifleman, and that's where you actually do a lot of shooting, a lot more live action, a lot more live ordnance, and to become that rifle Marine.
Rifleman. When did you graduate from Quantico?
November 71.
Okay, November 71. So the war in Vietnam is still going on. We're definitely in the downhill slope. By 1973, all ground forces are basically out of the picture. So you're looking at a path for training now that's basically going to not going to get you to Vietnam. You're not going to see any action in Vietnam because essentially the war's over in 73. And they were, you know, war planners were thinking that was the case by that time. And it sounds like from what you said, the Marines were already thinking about the problems they're going to have with an excess of lieutenants and captains when the war ends, and then needing new lieutenants to come into the system. Is that about right?
Well, I know that they were short of aviators for whatever reason. I knew they took the guns off the Hueys after post-Vietnam. And we spent another 10 years putting guns back on the Hueys because we were short gun ships in the Marine Corps. I know that there was a lot of lieutenants in these squadrons I was in and saw. We're all new guys. There was a few captains around, some majors who were Vietnam veterans and such. From my little world, you know, I was just fortunate to get in the window to be a officer and a pilot without a college degree. And the rest of the guys were in the same boat. Some of them went back and got the degree, which I did as well, but a lot of them did not. And
you said you graduated from OCS in November of 71. Did you also get commissioned then?
Yes.
Okay. But your status is an aviation cadet or something like that?
Nope. Unlike the other services, when you graduated from officer candidate school, you are commissioned a second lieutenant, period. Everybody goes to training basic school for 6 months. I went to Pensacola, Florida for training, pilot training. I say pilot training because at that time it could be in anything. It could be helo, fixed wing, or proper jets. It didn't really matter, but you're going to go for pilot training. And six of us went down at that time frame. And we just started. At that time, we're just second lieutenants going through pilot training. There was not a name to us. We weren't aviation cadets or anything. We were a Marines lieutenant in the Pensacola training program.
Okay. A couple more house cleaning questions for you here, Gary. Did you have a girlfriend at the time?
No. Actually, when I graduated from Quantico, went to Pensacola, it wasn't until halfway through my training. Training was lasted about a year. I met my wife, future wife, in, it had to be December, January time frame. Jim Cartwright, a good friend of mine, and he's the last of my class Marine who stayed in. He became a four-star general. Anyway, his first wife, they moved down, lived on the beach. Jim was in, he was a real backseat pilot. He didn't have the eyes at the time to become pilot. So he was in a different program, but in the same area. So anyway, he calls me up. I'm at Whiting Field, Naval Air Station Whiting Field. And he says, Gary, I got a small party at the house here. Why don't you come on over? So anyway, his sister, Cindy, came down, and her girlfriend, Susie, my future, they traveled around a lot together, and they were down there visiting. And as it worked out, Susie was the only one that wasn't matched up with somebody. So I'm not sure it was a set-up blind date or just come and enjoy yourself, whatever. But anyway, I met Susie at that time. And 6 months later and six visits later, we were married. Married in November.
Well, I would imagine that the Marine Corps had you fairly busy with aviation training in the meantime.
Well, they did, and this wedding kind of interfered with that. In fact, I ended up getting, I didn't pass a check ride. And at that time, you got three downs, as they call it, in the whole training program, from once you start to once you finish, three downs. If you get three downs, you were washed out of the program. And so I had my first down in the last stages of my training. And of course, when they asked me, you know, anything interfering with their thoughts and training and attention, I said, well, I'm getting married tomorrow. Well, that's good enough. We'll come back, give you a couple ETs, and continue on. That's exactly what happened. Went up Rockford, Illinois. We got married, drove back. The next day, we got there. I put her in this apartment complex. It was cheap. I wasn't going to be there very long, I thought. Unfortunately for Susie, when I left her at nights, I had night flights to do. The professional wrestlers in the town, they were there on weekends, Gorgeous George and all those guys, they all stayed the same place. So when I came back at midnight or 1 o'clock, the cops and the lights were trolling around. There was ambulances here, you know, because they all had fights around the area. Susie's in her room, says, Gary, what are you doing to me? You know, I ended up giving her my gun in case she got scared even more. But anyway, we were there for almost 3 weeks, longer than we were planned. So I got my wings in December, and there's a picture of her. We're pinning my wings on the ceremony, and then after that, we drove to California.
Was that December of 72 now?
Yes.
Okay, so roughly a year there in flight school.
Yes.
During that time period, then, was this strictly, were you progressing from basic trainers, fixed wings, to jets, to helicopters? How did that process go?
You start off with the ground school. I remember taking tests for aerodynamics and a few other stuff, you know, survival training and doing all your physical requirements as far as swimming goes, and all that was happening for about three weeks. Then we all went to Naval Air Station Softly, where we did T-34 training. And I already flown, by this time, now I already had my private license. I got my license, civilian license. So I had some flight time. In fact, I even had a flight in the T-34. So when I got in the aircraft, things weren't all that unfamiliar.
A T-34 was a fixed wing?
Low wing, fixed wing prop job. T-34B, Mentor was the name. It's a low wing aircraft. It's got tandem seats, you know, front and back, stick, throttle on the side, and nothing real fancy, basic training aircraft. In fact, they're still flying for basic training some places. But anyway, I sold in that, I think in like 10 hours or less, and it was the accelerator. They told me they accelerated me through the program because I didn't really need all the extra flights, which was good and bad, as I found out later on. But T-34 was the first step, and Naval Air Station Softly. Next station for all of us was Naval Air Station Whiting Field, where you did fixed-wing training. We flew a T-28 at that time, T-28 Charlie, which was the Navy version because the Air Force flew the T-28 as well. It has a great big engine like the P-51 and the Corsair, that big engine. And it's, again, tandem seating, a great big aircraft, it looks to me. But it's one of those aircraft when you sit in the front there and you're cranking it up and the blades are turning and the smoke is popping out. You kind of look back to the John Wayne movies and the carriers and all that kind of crap. That's how you had, that's the feeling you had, you know, back in that era with that kind of aircraft. So I flew that for, I got a couple hundred hours in that aircraft, about 100 hours plus. And you did formation, cross-country training, instrument flying. So at that stage is where I went to helicopters. Other people went to prop or fixed wing training. It could be jets or it could be propeller driven. We had the C-130 cargo plane. We also had the OV-10, a twin engine observation plane. And then, of course, you had jets. And so you left at that point based on your score and what the needs of the Marine Corps were.
A long time before in this interview, you mentioned what you wanted to do was to fly jets.
Jets.
What happened?
Well, now I'm in the Marine Corps, and I wasn't sure if I was going to stay a career in the Marine Corps. I figured I had an obligation of 6.5 years. And so I thought, well, if I get out in 6.5 years, I would have a lot better chance of getting a flying job if I had both helicopter training, helicopter rating and fixed wing rating. I can play both cards and hopefully be a more marketable pilot on the outside. And at that time, there was articles about the helicopter side coming more popular in the civilian side. So I went helicopters. And as it worked out, I ended up taking my tests later on, and I got both my ratings, helicopter and fixed wing.
Well, this is still, there's still American troops involved in Vietnam. And My understanding is that the casualty rate for helicopters and helicopter pilots was significantly higher than for fixed-wing aircraft. Would that be right?
Probably so.
Did that even factor into your consideration?
No, it did not. And to be honest with you, I didn't even think about the. I thought about the mission of the helicopter I was going to fly. I want to fly, and how do you figure out that? Well, you talk to other pilots who flew that aircraft or flew different aircraft. And of course, they all have their passions and reasons why they fly their aircraft. And of course, their aircraft is always the best aircraft. And so, unfortunately for me, there was more CH-46 pilots in I could talk to. And the CH-46 mission was to carry troops primarily, cargo secondarily, and medevac. And so they, the story goes, was that, well, you're at the forefront because the grunts are the ones or the fighting force should be moving the grunts around and supporting the grunts. And everybody else supports the grunts, but you are actually carrying, you actually planning missions with them because you have to get them on the ground. And that appealed to me. And so I went to CH-46 training, that's my desire, and West Coast was my coast of choice.
I think we've got a picture here that we can show of the CH-46. And did you start training on the CH-46 then only after you got to basically a duty station?
Yes. Once you got your wings.
Okay, there's the helicopter.
CH-46. Once you got your wings, then, of course, You put your dream sheet in. I wanted to fly this type of helicopter, and I want to go to this East Coast, West Coast. And so I had picked CH-46s, and coming from the West Coast, I picked the West Coast. And I was assigned to Marine Corps Air Station Santa Ana in California, and I was assigned initially to HMT, a training helicopter squadron that had both Heli-46s and a CH-53, and they gave both trainings. I was there for about 2 or 3 months and acquired my what they call a helicopter second pilot, H2P. And they do all the training. And
okay, now we've gotten into the military jargon here big time. HMT,
yes.
What would that stand for?
Helicopter, Marine Helicopter Training, HMT, 301. And the East Coast has 302. And then they have 303. And they're just different platform helicopters they train. The Cobras, TAC helicopters, or the Hueys, another utility aircraft were in different training groups.
And of course, when people think of Vietnam and they think of helicopters, everyone thinks of the Huey. The aircraft, though, that we looked at the picture a little bit earlier looks very similar to what the Army's CH-47 would be.
In fact, it's made by the same company, Boeing Vertol. The CH-47, the Chinook, they look at us, the Army guys, as a baby Chinook, and we look at them as a big 46, you know, so. But we have some of the same parts, and we have shared some parts that has Boeing labels on them, pitch link bearings, whatever. We exchange here and there when we get a chance. But it is a smaller version of the 47. There are differences,
Well, tell me about the characteristics of flying one of those and the crew, if you would.
Well, it hasn't got a tail rotor, and the Huey's got a tail rotor. In fact, almost all the helicopters have tail rotors, which has an inherent aerodynamic characteristics that you have to be careful of. Well, the 46 does not. It has two tandem rotors, counterclockwise, meshed together, synchronized, and it has three wheels. The wheel in the front's not steerable with the rudder or anything, pedals. It is canistered, where you have to move the aircraft up and down and then move the stick right or left to get it to go in that direction. So the true art of flying, the hardest part was taxiing this aircraft. Now, we call the aircraft the Frog, because from the back end, it looks like a frog with the bulging fuel tanks on the side and a nose in front. It looks like a frog. And so we always call ourselves a Frog Pilots, P-H-R-O-G, Frog.
I thought they called it a Sea Knight.
Well, that's the official name.
Okay.
But we all call it the Frog Flyers, and the Battle Frog, and, you know, the Killer Frogs. But CH-46, Sea Knight is the official name, yeah.
Was it a challenge to fly one of those?
It was. It's a more challenge to take in the size of this aircraft. Because when you land the aircraft, where you're looking at, just like you think of an airliner, you know, he's way up front, but the wheels are all in the back. When you land down, when you land the aircraft, whether it's on a runway or whether it's on a pinnacle, you got to be thinking about 30 feet behind you where those wheels would be sitting down. And you could sit down there and hold the nose off the ground, and that could be over a cliff, just let the grunts out, whatever it may be. But you're thinking of that. So the size of the aircraft is what the biggest adjustment was. You know, it was pretty stable, a stable aircraft. And all our aircraft, the military at that time, were, they had autopilot, they had stability systems, so it was pretty stable aircraft to fly, both in instruments and conditions. But it was a fun aircraft to fly. I mean, it was maneuverable. We would do air combat maneuvering with the aircraft, so we can move around pretty good with it. But the challenge was more to, from the Huey to go to the 46, is just to take it in the size of the aircraft was more the challenge. And then taxiing, because you knew if you were a rookie, because if you hit too hard, you bottom out. And if you pull back too much, the nose come off the ground. So you had to find that magic moment in there. And every aircraft's different. It had its own little personality by how that oleo strut moved up and down.
What was the crew size?
We had a pilot, co-pilot, and non-combat, we would have probably one crew chief and one guy in the back who's probably a corporal, he's a mechanic. During combat, we would have, our aircraft will hold two 50 caliber guns on the side, so we have two gunners on the side who would carry a couple thousand rounds of ammo. And then we have a crew chief, and he may even, depends on the mission, have a mechanic with them, so it'd be two, four, maybe six people total in that aircraft flying.
Did you have a specified ground crew as well, or did the ground crews work on all the aircraft?
In mission profile, there were no ground crews. At the squadron, we had ground crews that would work on all the aircraft. And they would see if we had aircraft problems, they would initially be coming out to help us to troubleshoot the problem, get it fixed, and go. But once you took off, there's just no ground crew to support you unless you call them from the squadron to help you.
What kind of missions? You talked about the troop transport. Anything else that the aircraft would be expected to do?
We did logistics, supply transport to support the grunts. Medevac was another one that we did. And actually, in early on there in California, we had two side missions. I didn't tell you about that earlier. We had two side missions. When the presidents came, was it Nixon and Reagan, when they came, they would have their West Coast place to hang out. HMX came. We were their backup to the HMX. So we actually had a VIP kit. This was when I first got to the West Coast. We would weekend duty, you're assigned, and we would take out the web seats, which usually had oil stains on them, and we would put in actually airline seats in them, bolt them in. They were red and vinyl covering, blocked off the back so you can't see it, and the whole works, a vinyl layout in the front. That was a VIP kit, and that was our, we would set the aircraft up, and sometimes we would fly to El Toro to stand by for the next 6-7 hours. While we were backup to the backup, but it was a mission. And the other one was that we got some training picking up, in fact, you see it now in the news, water bottles, water bags, and help to drop, put out fires. And we did some of that on the side. So that was a couple of things we did, not really a side mission, but some side tasks that we ended up learning to do while we were there on the West Coast.
Did you guys like that VIP mission?
No. No, like VIP missions.
Why not?
Just the nature of the beast. I remember a flight, and I was a co-pilot. This was in HMT 301. We had to move a general, two-star general, from someplace down at Camp Pendleton. We took off. We went through the clouds, got on top of the clouds, flew down to Camp Pendleton, and I'm trying to think of the pilot. I'll never forget it. We end up, and I'm just a fly along, and we're co-pilot. We're flying down. We see two peaks in Camp Pendleton above the clouds, the fog bank. So we fly to this peak over here. We hover over the top of the peak. We see a road. We air taxi down this freaking road just above treetops for about 3 or 4 miles. We get to the bottom. It opens up where I can see about maybe a mile and a half. We go over to the coordinates where the general was. We pick him up. And we move him 2 clicks, 2,000 yards, and let him down. And the car that dropped him off picks him up and takes him somewhere else. That's VIP missions. And that's just the nature of the word. They were just that way. You had to be there, and they were important missions. But from, you know, from a standpoint of what we did a lot of times, it just didn't make a whole lot of sense.
Did you enjoy the fire suppression missions a little bit more?
Yes, a little better.
Just a little better?
A little better, yeah.
Okay. How long were there in California then?
I was in the HMT, the training squadron, for about 6 months. Got there in January. I think I transferred out June, July time frame. We were in the blimp hangars. They're still there, in fact. And Goodyear still uses them when they come in there. But the blimp hangar had, I don't know, four or five squadrons. And so I was on one side of the blimp hangar, and I walked across to the other side of the hangar and checked into HMM, helicopter marine medium is what that stands for, 163 Evil Eyes. And Evil Eyes, for some reason, they had painted a couple of eyes on the front of the aircraft. And their Vietnam story was that when the Vietnamese, I guess, or the Viet Cong saw these aircraft with those eyes, and they came carrying troops, and they were shooting guns from their side to get them in the zones, they were, I guess, evil. And so Evil Eyes is how that name came about from the stories I've been told.
But that unit being in California illustrates that the military was basically out of Vietnam by the time you got to that unit.
Well, the units in California, we either go to on a cruise, a ship cruise for 6 months, or they would go to Okinawa for a year at a time frame. So the squadrons back in the States wouldn't normally be the ones taken out of Vietnam. The ones that maybe in Hawaii aboard ships probably came off. And I know we had airplanes stationed there, but yeah, you're right. Probably most from all out of country. And we support it from the ship side or our standby side, basically like in Okinawa.
Were you hearing lots of war stories from other members of the unit, some of the more senior members?
No. And that was the ironic thing I found, is that the only time you hear them talk about their experiences in Vietnam was at a bar, and they had to be half-tanked talking about it. They just didn't talk about it. And just like now, you hear some stories about World War II veterans or even Korean veterans. They just don't talk about their experiences either. It was so tragic, and they just didn't want to bring up those memories. But a lot of my friends, they were friends at the unit who came back. They were captains and sometimes majors. Then didn't talk about it. Now, the training we did was post there what they learned. We would fly initially when I got there, flying high, 1,500 feet, and we would get over to a LZ, a landing zone, and we would stay out of small arm fire, and we were trained to stay over that small area and do 360s, land and pop in the zone, and then that's what we did. So it was a lot of times it was just hand-eye coordination, more training, you know, to learn the aircraft, get the feel better. But it was also a practical use for it, too. And so then we went to when the surface-to-air missiles came around, the training went from the high 360s down to low altitude. So now we're below the trees, and we would kind of fly along the river beds and so forth and kind of pop up and then drop in.
Nap of the Earth. You guys like flying Nap of the Earth, don't you?
Yeah, we do. That's fun. Nap of the Earth flying is a challenge. You got to learn how to read a map and read the contours, but it's more fun to fly.
Okay. How long were you in California before you got your next post?
Actually, I was probably about a year. At the time, the Marine Corps had the individual replacement going on to Okinawa. And so there was 13-month tours going on in Okinawa. Different pilots from different areas. It was based on seniority. You've been there longer, then your time came up. Now, when your time came up, it was a quota system that came to the air group. The air group may get 10 pilot requirements for 46 pilots in Okinawa. And so they may put two here and two there and two there, and that's how, and the guys who were there the longest got tapped to go. And so it was when HMM 163, that's what the plan was. And Dean Kuntz was one of the guys who was assigned to go. And then before he left, they changed the mandatory requirement to a voluntarily requirement. You had to volunteer to go there. And so he said, I'm not going to volunteer, and so I left the open billet. And so I don't remember why I volunteered, but I volunteered to take his place.
So 13 months in Okinawa.
Yes.
Wouldn't that be an unaccompanied tour?
That's right. And I just got married.
So what did Susie say about that?
Well,
she knew what she was getting into when she married.
Well, I don't think she did. And I don't think she knew it even until halfway through my whole career. She said, "I don't know what I got into," But anyway, we were married. She had a small. She had worked at a job in a bank, and so we were looking for a house to buy. And the houses there were not were fairly inexpensive back in the 70s. But anyway, we decided when I had the orders to go for 13 months, she says, "Why should I stay here? I'll go home for a year. I'll live at home, work for my dad and all that," and that's what she did. So when I left, she came over to Okinawa one time, and honeymoons when you have them after you get married, not a year later, they don't count as honeymoons anymore. And so even though we took a trip to Hong Kong and Taiwan for 10 days, and that was, quote, our honeymoon, I think today she says, "No, we didn't have a honeymoon. I don't care what you call it, Gary." But anyway, but she didn't like it, obviously, and she went home. But that was 13 months is a long time. But then I got to go to Pensacola, Florida as a flight instructor, so I was there for 4 years. And so kind of
after the 13 month?
Yes, sir.
Okay. But it's the reason we're sitting here today is because of what happened when you actually got sent to Okinawa. When did you arrive in Okinawa?
It should be June of 74.
Okay. And what was your unit of assignment there?
I was assigned to HMM 165, called the White Knights.
Were you doing the same kind of missions you were doing in California?
Yes, doing the same thing, same mission. We did a lot of what we call NTA, Northern Training Area training. Okinawa is only some places in the northern part you trained at. There was some headquarter elements in around. I was stationed Marine Corps Air Station Fatima. Not too far from us was Naval Air Force, Kadena Air Force Base. But you had to go further north of the island to find Marine Corps ground units. Camp Hansen was up in that area. Camp Swab was in that area, all up there, and they were small camps. The northern area was training, and the grunts, the infantry unit, was to go up there as a company or a platoon, and they'd stay there for maybe a week, week and a half, 10 days, and they would be training in this jungle environment. Again, coming post-Vietnam, this three-tier canopy jungle was just is bad stuff to fight in, let alone train in, and this is what they were doing. So we would go up there and stand by overnight when they were in the field as a medevac, because the biggest fear was what they call the Habu snake, and there was at that time no anti-venom on the island unless there was some small places that had it, and it wasn't in very big supply. So we were there to carry the Marine if he got bit down there as fast as we could. Because it was, it killed a lot of Okinawans early on, and when I left after a year, they were just getting more and more anti-venom. But the Habu snake, northern training areas where we trained at, we would do small little LZs. We would practice landing in, but that's what we did. We land in these places, jungle penetrator cables through the jungle to pick up Marines on the ground, a three-tier. Jungle penetrator device that's on our hoist, and it's got a three-seat metal heavy thing that will punch through the three-tier, get down the bottom, they pull the three-prong thing out, and they strap themselves around it, and we pull them up. And that's how we extracted Marines in that kind of environment.
Were you a first lieutenant by this time?
No, not yet. I was a first lieutenant probably about halfway through my tour there, and so I was a first lieutenant before the evacuation started.
Okay.
I was still a helicopter second pilot, a co-pilot, and so I ended up, you had to have 500 hours total time as a minimum.
To be a co-pilot?
To be an aircraft commander. And so that was the next step you progressed to, co-pilot to an aircraft commander. And the difference is that he signs for the aircraft and he's responsible for the aircraft. I'm just his co-pilot.
Between the two of you, though, are you getting as much stick time?
It depends on who you're flying with, and he says, "I'm going to fly the aircraft," and you sit there and you monitor instruments and you get the pubs out and you go through the checklist, but you may not fly.
So that doesn't sound very exciting.
Well, it became who you flew with, and then most of the aircraft commanders knew that we were in training to get our check right to be an aircraft commander, so they would let us fly. And we would do certain things to try to work on some, you know, he'll ask, what do you want to do? I said, well, I could do some more combinary landings or high altitude landings. Sometimes we in California, we had some mountains to work. There weren't too many high altitude areas, but combined areas, we had a lot of them. Combined is just a small tight LZ to land it into. And you could do spirals with that small, or you can do a low altitude jump up in that small, but they're all small. And it took a little coordination, verbal coordination for your crew in the back to get you cleared in, settled down. How's the ground? How are we looking? 1 feet, 2 feet, you're cleared. Touchdown.
Did you have any additional duties, things that kept you busy when you weren't flying?
Well, in the Marine Corps, unlike the Army and Air Force, we have collateral jobs. In fact, you can get more trouble from your collateral job than you can from screwing up being a pilot. My collateral job was in maintenance, so I worked full-time in maintenance, and I would take a break from my full-time job to go fly. And so when I finished flying, do the debriefing, whatever paperwork, and I go back to my job, and I got a regular full-time job. I had a line officer, as they called it. I had about 40 to 50 mechanics and crew chiefs to work with. So I had people under me I had responsible for, accountability for the aircraft that we were working on. So it was a typical full-time job, and I would take a break from that to go fly.
How much maintenance time would it take for 1 hour of flight time, typically?
I think they advertise almost 6 hours to 1 hour, 4 to 6 hours to 1 hour of flight time. It's an old aircraft, and it's even more now because it's still flying. It's a 60. Of course, I got bumper stickers saying don't trust any aircraft under 40 years, and so...
By this time, did you think you were flying the best aircraft in the system?
Oh, I did, yeah. There was, you know, you have some guys who didn't want the 46, but got it because the needs of the Marine Corps at the time. And that's the criteria. The needs of the Marine Corps got you East Coast, West Coast, got you into a helo platform or a fixed-wing platform, whatever it may have been. And so the needs of the Marine Corps. But I felt I lucked out. I flew the 46. That was my choice. And today is still the best aircraft flying. It's the only aircraft worth flying, really.
Okay.
Because I flew the Huey, too.
Yeah.
So
let's get into early 1975.
Yeah.
And what happened then that got you guys steaming south towards the South China Sea?
Being in maintenance kept me in the dark. And being a second lieutenant and first lieutenant wasn't in the... You didn't have a whole lot of need to know sometimes, other than you had to get aircraft prepared to fly mission profile-wise. And so it was in that time frame where we were talking about not a Saigon evacuation, but to go support, I can't remember what we were talking about. I don't remember it being talked about evacuation. I remember we had to get aircraft ready. We had our squadron was 18 aircraft. And now our squadron was getting ready to go composite. And I say composite meant we have 18 46s, we were going to get 4 53s, 2 Hueys, and 4 Cobra gunships. That's a composite squadron. And we were getting ready to go composite because they had planned to go aboard ship for 6 month cruise. So that was a precursor that we were going under. Then all of a sudden, this was we were getting aircraft ready to fly and to go aboard ship. And I remember we were flying, going to go off the coast of Vietnam, and that's really all I knew at the time. And so we were putting aircraft on ships that came by, ships of opportunity. And so the USS Blue Ridge, a communication ship, came by, and we put 2 on that one. They serve great meals there. They have lobsters all the time.
I think we've got some pictures here for it, too. There's the Blue Ridge on the bottom.
Yeah. Yeah, the Blue Ridge. And so we put 2 helicopters on that one. Those guys had it pretty good. They got to eat in flight suits and all that good stuff and good food. The USS Dubuque, we had 6 46s on that one. We put 1 in the hole, which is a little hangar-like, and 2 on the side. 3 and 2 on one side, 1 on the other. So we had 4, and we put 1 on the first deck closer to the hangar, and 1 in the back open was open. So we had 6 aircraft on that one.
LPD, what does that stand for?
Landing platform. I don't know.
Well, the Navy calls it an amphibious transport dock. Yeah. An amphibious transport dock.
Well, the back of the thing opens up, and they have amphibious vehicles that the Marines are on that come floating out of there and hit the shoreline.
So it's kind of a mixture of that and a helicopter carrier?
Normally the aircraft aren't on this ship. This is like you just mentioned it, that's what their mission is. So the aircraft, this ship would have a couple thousand Marines, all infantry, to hit the shore from these amphibious vehicles. Now, we use this ship, the opportunity to get our aircraft out there, because that we had the Blue Ridge, we had the Dubuque, now the next ship was a Hancock, USS Hancock, an aircraft carrier. And so we put the rest of our aircraft on that one. And so, but that's the ships we had available. Now, they all couldn't go on the Hancock.
All the helicopters, you mean?
Yeah, we couldn't get the whole squadron on the Hancock.
Well, I'm sure that the Hancock had a full complement of its own aircraft.
That's right. And they also had other helicopters from other places. So the point was that we used the Blue Ridge for two. We used the LPD for what we could get on there. They figured six. And the rest went on to the Hancock.
Well, let me take just a minute or two to kind of give some more background to what's going on at this period of American history. 1973, the Paris Peace Accords are signed, and it divides up South Vietnam so that the North Vietnamese are allowed to occupy huge portions of South Vietnam, but there's supposed to be some kind of a transition towards peace and open elections and things like that. That obviously is going on. Shortly thereafter, there's the Watergate scandal, and so the American public gets distracted in a big way, especially late 73, 74, by Watergate. But the North Vietnamese aren't distracted, as you well know. And in early 1975, North Vietnam launches a major offensive with the goal in mind of occupying the entire country. Now, the American ground forces are out, but there's still plenty of Americans in advisory roles and in the embassy and lots of other capacities. And so that's, I think, part of the reasons why. I don't know if you were sent out to the fleet because of that, or it just happened to coincide.
I know we were not the primary exit plan. The exit plan was the airliners and the transport aircraft to fly all the Americans out of Saigon. And of course, they're all being pushed into the Saigon area. And so that was a primary exit plan. I think we were sent out there as a backup to that plan. And there were some other plans for refugees, but we weren't part of, quote, the refugees. We were there primarily to support our embassy that we had there and the Marines and what army, what services were still there to support them. But again, their plan was to go out via the big airliners. And when they started bombing the airfields, that kind of knocked that opportunity out.
What I'd like to have you do then is, and when we sat down and you explained this to me before, there was a lot of movement back and forth between the Philippines and South Vietnam and back and forth. So what I'd like to have you do is just kind of lay out that chronology as best you can for me.
Well, we get off the coast initially, and we sit there, and there was no plan for us to be used yet. This was the bombing may have started by then, but the plan was still the air transport planes to get the people out of the country. So we sat there, and now we're getting hit with a bunch of junket ships. I call it Chinese junket ships. Refugees were cruising out there. We're several miles out, and they're coming out, and we hear the hull banging at night and days trying to get back in.
I got a good picture of that, too. Go ahead.
And so we're sitting there, and the ship didn't have a mission. We didn't have any mission, but we're moving grunts from one ship to the other ship, back and forth, staging for possibilities, consolidating our assets, because we all kind of jumped on a ship of opportunity. And again, our squadron was divided among four ships.
Which one did you end up on?
I was on Dubuque, the LPD. So we actually got a mission, our ARG, Amphibious Ready Group, to go back to the Philippines, which was, if I remember correctly, a day and a half, maybe 2 days of sailing. So, anyway, we sailed back. We no more get there. We weren't there very long. All of a sudden, we get told to go back to our holding spot off of Vietnam. So we head back out there. Again, we still moved troops around from ship to shore, ship to ship. There was a couple of flights I had where I was following Hueys along the shoreline, and we were just looking to see, well, they were looking to see, the Hueys had the VIPs in them. We were a backup to the M1 CH-46 and two Hueys, and we were told to stay feet dry. So we're sitting there, we're flying, but the ships are out holding spots. We didn't have any missions per se assigned to the helicopters, and so we were just told to escort this Huey and don't go feet dry. Well, so all of a sudden we fly north, and you see all these ordnance going off on the shoreline. Now we were about a half a mile from the shoreline. We see all these explosions going off. They weren't shooting at us. They were more or less bombing the shoreline to keep the refugees from escaping. One little town, I remember, got bombarded, a whole lot of ordnance, and it was mostly to keep the ships from sailing and people from evacuating, because obviously they were escaping and they were coming down, I guess, control. So we saw all that, so we kind of moved a little further offshore. The next thing I knew, the Hueys were gone. They went inland someplace and never saw them again. And so Klaus Schag, I never forget his name, we sit there and we call the ship and says, you know, we're beyond a point of no return on fuel. Can you help us out by moving our way? And he said, okay. So they sailed full speed, so helped us in our flight back. We landed with, you know, on fumes just about. But that was the only, so it was the kind of flying we were doing, ship to ship with troop movements, moving some people around. I remember doing the...
some Vietnamese refugees?
No. No, we're not carrying any refugees. We're just carrying Marines from ship to shore, ship to ship, supplies ship to ship. Sundays we didn't do anything but a mail run or a chaplain run.
Well, how about these VIPs you were talking about?
I don't know. They came off a Huey off the Hancock somewhere.
So these are military Americans?
I don't know who they were. I just know that we were escorting them.
They could have been South Vietnamese bigwigs?
They could have been some people, yes.
And you talked about these ships, these boats, whatever the Vietnamese would be able to get to. They had to be desperate. Were they trying to get to your ships?
Well, yeah. And they were banging the ship hull with some hammers or whatever they had metal-wise, because it would ring the holes. And sometimes at night, we'd get up, you know, four or five, you know, ships around our big ship. We're sitting there. We're not moving. We're just sitting there. And these Chinese junkers, like you see in Hong Kong, those little ships, are banging the hulls, you know, trying to get help, trying to get aboard. And that wasn't our mission. We didn't really have room for them to take on the potential thousands that would come to our ship. So that was what we didn't take them on. We ended up moving the ship further offshore, if I remember correctly, got a little further away from them. And so, but that's what we did. And then we didn't pick any up. We end up, because we sit around for a few days, I remember going back to the Philippines. You know, we got sent back to the Philippines at this time, again, because we're delayed in what's going to happen. The transport planes aren't going to be working now. So now I think they were consolidating the people, consolidating efforts at the embassy and the compound itself. Meanwhile, we weren't doing anything. So we go back to the Philippines. Then we get to the Philippines and say, well, now head back out. So we made two trips to the Philippines. Then we headed back off to the coast of Vietnam again, Mekong Delta area.
What was happening to all these desperate Vietnamese on these Chinese junks that were trying to get someplace, somewhere that would take them in?
They were just cruising out. They weren't being sought after by the bad guys. They were out there, at least they were off the shorelines, and a junker just floating around.
You don't really know what happened to them, though?
Do not. Now, I do know that a lot of these merchant ships gathered a lot of these refugees to help get them off out of Vietnam, and the merchant ship became another problem by itself. And so when we got back to the coast, the merchant ships was now loaded with people, running out of food, running out of medical supplies, and the ship captain lost control. So the refugees that was on the ship, there were some bad guys in there, because a lot of these refugees were not really refugees. They were Vietnamese, you know, regulars who just changed uniforms and just became refugee. And now they took control of the ships.
wonder if we can get a picture of one of those here up in just a minute or two. Okay. And go ahead and keep talking then.
So we now had, our ship had a mission, because the only place they could go.
And is that an example of one of these merchant ships?
That's a barge there. That barge is loaded with people, and you got a tugboat that's moving it around on that north top side of it. And so they were obviously in need of medical supplies and everything else. And our ship had security, and we had medical teams to support this. But we weren't going to do them in open water. We were going to do them. They were told to go to a place called Fuquoc Island.
And you can see that it's on this map. It's way to the left of that map. It's right close to the border between Cambodia and Vietnam, is that correct?
And Thailand's up in that area there as well.
Okay.
So they were told to go there. All the merchant ships were told to kind of go there because they can be offloaded there. And so the ship had a mission. The Marines didn't. We were attached to the ship. So the ship sailed to the Fuquoc Island area. We get there, and it was at least two merchant ships. And I don't remember seeing that barge anymore, but it went someplace. But I know we got there, and I think I got a picture as well where they show a couple of amphibious vehicles, ship vehicles, going to the merchant ships with security teams, as medical teams, to hopefully, one, establish control of the ship, get the ship back under control of the ship captain and ship crew, as well as supply any medical support that they can. And we were there for maybe a day or two doing that. Now, we just flew around, and you saw, I took pictures of the barge and some other merchant ships we took pictures of, basically, but the air side of the house didn't have a mission. We were there to support the ground guys and the ship, and that was about all. But Fuquoc Island now was a place they were supposed to be offloaded. Well, I remember, and you can see it with binoculars, but we flew around as well, that some of these, the people in charge of the shoreline, the administration people, weren't going to allow them to get off. And so now we saw refugees jumping off the merchant ships, and some had looked like a 2x4. They were floating on, they were kicking toward the shoreline. Now, they weren't very far off the shore, maybe a mile, which is not really far, particularly with a big merchant ship. But anyway, we saw a bunch of these refugees jumping off the ships, and they were swimming towards the shoreline. I remember that they were a bunch of military people in the shoreline, and they were shooting at them. They weren't going to let them come. So they shot most of those refugees that came over there. But that didn't stop the people from jumping. They just kept jumping, thinking they can get there, and they just kept shooting them.
Any idea of the ones who were on shore, were they North Vietnamese or Viet Cong or just South Vietnamese that were...
I think they were South Vietnamese because we ended up coming back to Fuquoc Island to do another mission. And obviously the same place, if they were North Vietnamese, we wouldn't have been able to do that mission if they were, because they would have probably shot us down, obviously. But I think they were South Vietnamese, or maybe they didn't get the word that they were going to come there. I don't know. I just know they weren't going to let these refugees come off. But the ship eventually left, and so did we.
What's going through your mind watching all this? And basically, there's not much you can do.
There wasn't much we can do, and we weren't sure what we were going to do. Each mission seemed to be, okay, how long are we going to do this? Are we going to take on those junker ships, those Chinese junker ships with people on them? What were we going to do? We weren't going to pick them up. At the same time, we're here supporting the refugees. We were also kind of in the background working on a plan to go into Saigon for the embassy and compound. That was kind of a terse thought because we weren't given any orders to plan yet, to my knowledge. But at the same time, we weren't going to sit back and wait to be surprised and all of a sudden plan. So they were doing some planning off and on, from my understanding, at least the CO, the operations officer, I think the maintenance officer was on my ship. So the planning element was there. And, of course, we were conversing with other ships and other commands and making the plan work, or come up with a plan, what we were going to do, where we're going to go, and a time frame to do it all. We're doing all this kind of off and on while we're in Fuquoc Island, while we're sailing and all this stuff. We have meetings in the operations room with the OPSO, and we were talking about different elements of planning and different aspects of what we're going to do. And getting our, of course, I worked in maintenance at the time, So I was strictly mainly on the maintenance side of the house, making sure aircraft was ready to go, make sure our 50 cal guns were ready to go as well, and all that. So the thought was preparing, getting our aircraft ready to go, getting our troops ready to go, make sure we're set to go with what we needed, we thought what we needed. And again, I'm a first lieutenant now, and I don't know a whole lot about what we do need. And so I was asking questions of some of the more experienced people in my maintenance department who had Vietnam experience. And really, as it works out, it's not a whole lot more than we plan normally. We plan the aircraft, get it ready. All the operational things are functional, they're fixed and checked to go. We have our machine guns ready to go. They're set up. We got backups, guns in case they jam, we can't fix them. And that's really all we had aboard our aircraft. Of course, they gave us our TO weapon for our aviator is a 38 pistol.
A TO weapon?
A table organization weapon for a pilot is a 38 pistol. And that's what I qualify with all the time, every year. Of course, the M16 is what they end up giving us, but we never shoot them. You know, we just shoot them one time a year at the FAM shooting. But that's about it. And we did qualify for them, but that's not our what we call TO weapon. So the weapons they normally would give us would be that 38. So anyway, so we made sure we had all that ready to go when time came. And it was kind of the preparatory side of the house.
In other words, up to this point, you guys hadn't been actually flying over South Vietnamese land itself.
No, we didn't. No, none of us flew even close to the shoreline other than my mission at one time. We were parallel on the coast. Other than that, we were not allowed to get any close. And every time we heard, in the time I flew, they were using mortars, as we found out, launching to the shoreline to keep all the refugees, what they could, from escaping. So that was going on a lot. And so that was also, as far as I'm concerned, a pretty good barrier not to go in.
So after this experience at Phu Quoc, did you then the ships return to the area of Saigon?
We did. We returned back there, and now the Chinese junkers are tenfold more. They're everywhere, and so we were further off shoreline because we were moving now more, but the junkers were out there. I guess it was getting closer to the fall, and they came out more in desperations. At this time frame, I remember when we started getting the aircraft, the helicopters being flown out of Saigon onto the ships. And so, again, a desperation moment because we had one Huey land. It was a military pilot who brought his family, cousins, and relatives.
These are South Vietnamese?
Yes.
Okay.
He stole the aircraft, and he flew out to land it somewhere, someplace, and he landed on our ship.
I think we've got pictures of this as well.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So we landed the helicopter, we land aboard the ship. This is the CH-46. We were transporting, I think, some of the refugees away. The one on the right is where someone were being brought down off this Huey that landed. We were brought down, interrogated, stripped of any kind of weapons they may have been carried. Of course, we found suitcases of gold in that case. You know, some of these people brought what they had was gold and some weapons, but most were families. And so as soon as they got the people off the ship, at the top deck, got them down, my maintenance guys would say, okay, you got 5 minutes to take whatever you can get off the aircraft. So I sent my avionics guys out there to take whatever he could off the Huey that might be compatible. And we all just pushed the Huey off the ship. Because we were fearful that more would try to come, and we were feared that they would crash the helicopter, and then the flying debris would break our aircraft up. Now we can't do our mission. That was mostly the fear we had. So that landed. We had one land in the water close to our ship. They just didn't know how to land on a aircraft carrier or ship. So they landed in the water. They climbed out. We ended up picking those people up because they're sitting out there now floating. So we picked them up. Other ships had other helicopters being landed on. A Chinook landed on the Hancock, and it was pushed over once they got everybody off that one. So there was no room for these aircraft. And a Chinook is not ship compatible. The blades don't fold, so you can't. It's just a big sore spot. It takes up space. So we pushed that one off. They did. So that was the time frame that was going on this time for about 2 to 3 days was this ongoing. Weather was sky blue. water was, I call it water skiing, perfect, calm, no movement. It was a beautiful day, you know. It was this time frame was ongoing. And these ships, you can hear them, people talking and around the area because it's kind of quiet at night. And but yeah, that's what the moment was going on. So now I gave you a picture, but it didn't come out very good. And this is what had my concern, because we would catch the intelligence briefing of the North Vietnamese moving in. And we're getting the, and they were posting the threat on the map. I took a picture because it scared me almost, because we heard about the surface-air missiles. And they're now, and we had, at this time, we had kind of figured we were going to fly up the Mekong and kind of turn to the west or turn left to the compound.
So go into South Vietnam itself.
Yes. And so we were looking at that, and I remember each day I go in to look at the map, each day had more and more surface-air missile symbols along our path of flight. I'm thinking, we're going to die. There's no way we can get in there, what we had planned to do, and not get shot at.
And what was it that you were planning to do?
We were planning to go into the, we initially had the embassy, we called the embassy snatch, embassy raid, pick up the ambassador, but he wasn't ready to go. And so as things fell apart on the ground and the compound and the embassy, we started going in there. It was like a 3-4 level plan. There was aircraft that was assigned to the embassy itself. There was aircraft planned to go into the compound itself. There was aircraft 46s planned to be what we call feet dry search air rescue. We had what we had a Sparrowhawk. We had Marines aboard our aircraft that was going to land. We land the aircraft, provide a perimeter, get the good guys out of our aircraft, get them on board, and get them out of there. That was what we called feet dry. Then we had feet wet search air rescue, where we stayed feet wet and we had patterns to stay at, places to hold at, in case something got shot down and made it to the water, or something happened in the water when they landed in the water and crashed. We were going to be searching for them. So we had this element all the way back. So we had all of our aircraft utilized in the plan. And so I was a co-pilot for our CO, Colonel Jim Kaiser. And so we took off, and another story was that We took off in a rush, because the day before we had this plan, and we remember, I think L hour was like 08:07:30. Well, L hour to the Air Force and L hour to the Marines were different time frames. So we woke up saying we are an hour late because of what we interpret L hour. So now we're rushing to get done. We get our flight suit on, we get everything set up, and we're launching aircraft. We're moving the aircraft out to launch and take them off. Move out two more, launch, take off. So we're in this rush to get going. Of all the days, 33 days I was on the ship, it was sky blue and water skiing water. I mean, it was perfect. The day of, overcast, high thunder bumper clouds, rain, misery, low ceiling, low visibility, and we're taking off in this stuff. And so we took off early, we got going, and we were late. I don't know. I mean, we interpret the L hour, and we might have got off in time. But my mission was with Jim Kaiser, the CEO, and we flew, and we were feet wet SAR. So we had two 46s, and we were orbiting this one point. Everybody was going in the shoreline and going in, and the other crew was inland about 2 miles or so. They were going to orbit about kind of halfway. And at this time, we couldn't fly low because we were afraid we were going to run into more visibility problems. We'd fly higher. So now we're up around 4,000 or 5,000 feet, in and around the thunder bumpers and so forth. We could see the ground off and on. It wasn't overcast, but enough where I could see the ground and so forth. And, of course, we were feet wet. And then the other guys, we got a little close to feet dry. The CO wanted to go in. So we started heading in, if I remember what the colonel said. We're going to fly in and take a look at the things because his aircraft and his people going in and doing this, he wanted to have a better bird's eye view. So we departed our holding spot because all the planes are now gone feet dry. So we're out there just 2 46s by ourselves sitting there orbiting around, and things are going off. And so we started feet dry, and then all of a sudden he gets a call on the radio from the ship captain and from the higher command, says he cannot go in. He needs to return to the ship ASAP, as soon as possible. He didn't know why. He was upset because he didn't get a chance to go in and see what was going on, see what his airplanes were doing, where they were going, the conditions of setup, how bad was the threat, so he had a better bird's eye view. So when he went back or got back, he can now better assess his higher-ups, better assess support needed and all that. That was his motivation for going in. And so we didn't go in. And so we got back to the ship, the two of us, and the ship was on a move. The ship was going back to Fuquoc Island. At the time, we didn't know why. And so we finally landed on the ship. And meanwhile, the evacuation is now unfolding to what you see in the movies, as far as the compound being, you know, beaten down from the gates. The embassy is still intact. There's a good friend of mine who was a forward air controller with the infantry, you know, on the ground. He was on the top of the embassy giving calls to us, coordinating the flights in and flights out for all that. So he was doing that.
I think we've got a picture of that as well. It's not your picture, but
right.
That's the classic photo of the desperation of people trying to get out of the embassy.
And that's just the top part. The compound was packed. And from what the guys were telling me, he said they could no more get there, and he had Marines on the ground providing security so they don't just swamp the aircraft. We can only take so many. The 46 can take, well, we call them gooks at the time, but we can only take 25 seats. But we were loading more on there because they were smaller in stature and weight, so we can carry more. The 53s were carrying like almost 50 of them, and they had more. They can carry heavier weight, and they had more room to carry the cubic feet. But anyway, they were loading them all up to get them out of there, and it was an endless process. They no more get back to the ship, unload them, and they go right back out there, and they're doing this whole time. And the 46 has a 6-hour operational limits. After 6 hours, you got to shut down, check the heads. We have oil heads and so forth. Shut down. They're all good. We cranked right back up, and they went back out again. They did this for almost 24 hours, and they still left people behind, obviously. And that picture you had up there was probably one of the last calls. And I remember on radio, the high-frequency radio, either it was President Ford. Someone said it was President Ford that we need to get the ambassador out of there now. So at that time is when the Huey was going in there to pick up just the ambassador and his family and so forth. Jerry Berry was one of our pilots, and he was one of the guys who flew, I think, the longest hours in this process, and he was the last helicopter to fly out of the compound, if I remember correctly. Jerry Berry at the time was a captain, ended up being retired as a colonel, but he was a captain at the time, and he, the annual May movie or showing of the historical aspects of the evacuation, Jerry Berry was on that TV giving his viewpoints of what was happening from his viewpoint. So, but anyway, that was, so I'm aboard ship now, and this is all going on, and we're sailing, and now it's getting dark, and we get to Fuquoc Island, it's light, you know, early morning phase, and, we didn't really have a mission, to my knowledge. What the ship had a mission of, you know, the helicopters were flying out the Mekong Delta towards the ship holding spots, and they were all different stages and such. And that was one escape route for the helicopters. It was, I guess, given to the helicopter squadrons or the pilots there. You can come out this way, or you can go out towards Thailand. Well, you can't make it to Thailand with the fuel. So the ship was going to be sitting there to refuel them so they could fly up to Thailand.
And these are South Vietnamese aircraft just trying to get out of countries as much as they could?
Well, they had Army stickers on them, so there were Vietnamese pilots who flew them. At that time, I think there was mostly Vietnamese pilots, and these airplanes had families on them. They weren't carrying other military guys. They were taking care of themselves because they could fly the Hueys, and they were loading up their aircraft, and they knew the plan to go that direction. So when we got there, obviously there was no aircraft orbiting. So Skipper and
there being Fuquoc, you talking
about? Yes, area. So now Skipper and I, General Colonel Kaiser, we got in the aircraft, went looking for them. This is why I say if there were North Vietnamese on that island, we would have been prime targets. But we flew all around those areas there looking for Hueys that might have been on the ground. And we found, I think, three of them, three Hueys. And so we would orbit around them and try to signal and kind of follow us. So they would crank up and they would fly back to the ship. And we had Air Force pilots aboard the ship, as I found out, because we refuel those Hueys. The Air Force pilots got in the aircraft and they flew to Thailand. And we would go back and get the other aircraft and have them follow us, and because they were out of fuel, nowhere else to go.
U.S. Air Force pilots that would take the aircraft off the aircraft carrier, but with all the South Vietnamese that were on those ships?
I don't remember that part of it.
Did they stay on the ships with you?
I didn't see them get out. If they got out, it was some other time frame. How, I don't know.
Was this daylight now when this is going on?
This is early morning, yes. So we were there for hours, found all we could of the Hueys that might have flown out. I remember three of them. I also remember that the Air Force pilot, he had about two or three cruise boxes, which is 4 feet by 2 foot, half feet wide. And we had, they were full of weapons, 45s, machine guns, everything, mini guns. And the ship wasn't authorized to have them. We were going to dump them over the shoreline, over the side of the ship, because we were taking them off the Vietnamese and off the aircraft that flew to our ship. So the Air Force pilot says, yeah, we'll take them. So we put them in the aircraft. They flew them all to Vietnam, up to Thailand. So I remember that one because I was on the ground for that segment of it. And then I went back out again, and more aircraft came in. And of course, when they landed, you couldn't land because they occupied the only spot. And so we had to wait till they refueled and got back on, reloaded, and took off. Then we kind of came back in and landed. So there may have been some refugees on there, depends on who they were. I know there were some high-level refugees, I call them refugees, high-level officials from the South Vietnam government. They were treated like VIPs, I remember that. And who they were, I don't know. I know that some of my crew chief says, well, Gary, our lieutenant, there was gold in those suitcases they had. It wasn't clothes or anything. So, that's the stories we heard at that time. So we were there for several hours, and finally, that kind of dried up. So the ship now had hours to go to get back to the holding spot off Vietnam. And we got back there, and I remember we took off and flew again, if I recall, and all these ships were just sitting out there like they were dead in the water, and they were just sitting out there dead in the water. And the Chinese junker ships were just banging the hulls. They're everywhere out there now. And all our airplanes were on ships, but different ships. And so eventually, we reorganized the aircraft to be on the ships that they came out on, and that took a little process to get organized. And I was in what they call CIC, Combat Information Center, where the high-level operations is going on. I remember on the high-freak radio, some high-ranking individual says, get the ship going and get the hell out of here. Let's move. And so the ship started cranking up and it started moving, and we all kind of headed back out of that area.
Towards where?
Well, we were heading towards the Philippines. And we didn't get to the Philippines because we got about halfway there, and then we started proceeding towards Okinawa. And in this time frame was when the Mayaguez was being taken down. And so now the ship started cruising to the Mayaguez. And we had about, I don't know, 5 or 6 hour cruise to get to that place. Meanwhile,
and that was off the coast of Cambodia.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the Marines were aboard Air Force 53s coming out of Thailand.
What's the name of that helicopter again? CH-43s?
CH-53s. 53s? It's what we call a heavy hauler, nicknamed the shitter because it leaks oil everywhere. But anyway, so.
Because you were flying a better aircraft.
That's right. Well, I fly a better aircraft. But anyway, so the Marines were in that aircraft, and they had done a lot of overflights of the island, and they couldn't find any threats. And so the Air Force flew in like they would fly into any air base in the States, and basically got the shit shot out of them. We lost a lot of Marines that day.
Yeah, that ended tragically, though. It ended up with we were able to rescue the SS Mayaguez in the process,
right.
But a lot of Marines died, as you mentioned. What did you and your fellow pilots think about after all that had been spent on all the lives that had been spent on trying to keep South Vietnam free from communist control? What did you and your fellow pilots think about this evacuation and the collapse of South Vietnam?
Well, to be honest with you, there wasn't a whole lot of talk about that level of operations. It was more or less of what we did and how we did it. And of course, we were looking at, of course, some of the Vietnam veterans who had tours over there already had a different perspective than the guys like me who were just aboard for the first time aboard ship. A lot of them, you know, they ran missions supporting the grunts. And of course, we would fight for days and Marines killed us to occupy one spot on the ground and then later on give it back up and move somewhere else and hold that spot and lose Marines. And it seemed like it was moving around like that. And of course, the fixed-wing guys, we've got stories of, were bombing hillsides with nobody on them just because of the political environment that we were in. That kind of discussion was going on. The fact that we were finally coming to a climax, that we were completed, was probably good in that regard. Sad that we had to end it this way, where South Vietnam, if I remember correctly, why we were there was back to the old, to prevent the old domino theory of the communists taking over. And so we were going to stop this domino effect. And the fact that we lost in that regard, that South Vietnam surrendered in total to North Vietnam, was a collapse of that. And now we're just trying to get out with our skins and get all we can out of the country, our fellow service members. But I don't remember a whole lot of discussion about that level. You know, this was a tragedy. We should never have been there to start with. You look at a Marine who's getting told to go, we train for a mission, we get told to go do a mission, we execute the mission, we get out and move on to the next mission. So those are the kind of thoughts of the Marines you have. Not criticizing the politics as such, yeah, we all have our opinions. And when you're active duty, you kind of keep those opinions in close quarters because you just don't want to be publicly known for be anti-governmental, anti-whatever. Now, there's also, but you know, ironically, the people who flew before just didn't have a whole lot to say, and they still don't have a whole lot to say, and a lot of them.
Well, we're coming up to the 40th anniversary of those events next year. Do you have any reflections or opinions about what you experienced directly and what happened to South Vietnam?
Personally, it was one of those experiences that, you know, it pretty much stayed with you. We did lose one helicopter in that flight. They crashed in the water, and we lost all four members of that flight. So we did have a tragedy in our case. And so that was sad. And you think of the Marines you lost in that for that reason. You look at what we accomplished, which is categorized as the largest evacuation in the history of our country. And so we were part of that. So that's something to be proud of. And we did it well. And we executed it as planned. And in the story, I think I told you before, was that this route we planned, I was being a lieutenant. I'm not normally in the ops, neither no side of the house. But a friend of mine, this Captain Klaus Shaggett, said, walking down the hall, said, "Gary, come with me." So I go with him. We walk into the CO's stateroom. And he's got the operations guy. He's got the intel guy. And he's got this big map. You can't have alcohol aboard ship, but he had a bottle of Jack Daniel. So we were passing around shots, and I'm just a lieutenant in this equation, sitting back and watching, what the hell are we doing here, you know? And so they're planning the flight. They're planning this route up the Delta, and we're going to make a left turn, we're going to hit this checkpoint, and we're going to this compound, here's the embassy and all that stuff. And they're planning all this, and they're going to say, okay, what are we going to call these places? What are we going to call this? I don't know, white, and this is red. And they named all these sites, you know, checkpoints to go into. Well, I didn't think much of it. And next thing I know, next day or two, I'm reading on the classified information this plan with these names. And I says, I was there. We did all this, you know, 2 days ago, you know, with the CO and all that. So it was kind of looking back, that was says that. And even during Desert Storm, the planning we did wasn't too much from that, a little bit more formalized. But you sit around with the best players you got, and you come up, well, here's a terrain, here's your mission, how are we going to get there safely, you know, what are we going to do for backup, what about this, what if games all the way through. And that's what we did. And it was kind of exciting at the time that I was involved in that, you know, head on with that, and then be able to fly with the commanding officer as his co-pilot. And I felt pretty privileged in that regard because, you know, he picked me to fly with him, as I found out, versus just a random assignment. I've flown with Colonel Kaiser. We flew to the Philippines from Okinawa a couple times. And so anyway, so it was unique in that regard, and I felt privileged for where I was doing and where I was at. hindsight, I kind of wish I got to go in country just to see what the other guys saw. Other than that, more of a curiosity than anything else. I do remember, you know, we had no countermeasure for surface-air missile. And I know Captain Bud Moose, he was our maintenance guy, stayed back in Okinawa. He sent us a classified message. And, of course, the surface-air missiles, we had no countermeasures aboard the aircraft. And so he had to physically see the plume, the white plume being shoot at you before you know what was happening. So we were talking about using fairy pistols, which is a pistol that shoots out a flare signal. And we had two or three of those aboard the aircraft. And the plan was, if we see this plume come at us, we're supposed to turn the aircraft away, reduce power a little bit to reduce the heat, and shoot a fairy pistol out the right side, at the side that we're turning away from. And that would create a heat signal for that missile to come after. Well, you're talking about seconds. You're talking about seconds from, if you're 4,000 or 5,000 feet, you got about 4 seconds, 4 to 5 seconds before you see it, before impact. So it made us feel good, but I'm not sure the practicality of it all. But we had a lot of crews were reporting these of plumes coming at them in the early morning. And after the fact, we found out there were other fairy pistols being shot up in the air. But when you're in the kind of a, not quite dark, but you know, twilight and morning, and you're 3,000 or 4,000 feet, and you see this white plume come at you, you don't know what it is.
Guys have parachutes?
No. You don't have parachutes. Don't fly high enough to use them. So, hindsight is that, a couple little personal aspects of the evolution. The fact that I volunteered, my buddies from California came 6 months later. And that 6 months made the difference because I was back in Okinawa and they all started coming back on board. So I looked at it and said, if I never volunteered, I wouldn't have been involved in this. So a lot of things fell in place to get me where I was at.
So you're proud that you had the chance to be there?
I do. And proud to be able to serve in this environment. There was no combat per se, but we did get to fly in and around Vietnam. For new lieutenants like me who did, it was a feather in their cap. I got to fly what we did and saw what we saw. And the pictures I have was kind of unique to have as memories to start with. But, it was sad that we lost South Vietnam. I know we lost a lot of Marines and soldiers across the board in support of that. From that, experiences carried on, follow-on training that I got involved in the 80s.
And we will save that one for the next session.
Yeah.
When you got back and you finally got back and spent some time with Susie, did you tell her about what you'd gone through?
Not in detail. The less she knew, the better off she was, because the more she knew, I think the more she gets scared. And part of the more I told her, it says, man, you look back and more in hindsight, and it's like anything else, you wonder, how do I get out of this? How come they didn't shoot at us? We didn't get shot at all in this whole evolution. The only airplane we lost was we flew it in the water. And so we wonder, how come they didn't? Some theories were that they didn't want to start another war because they knew they would have one at this point if we did shoot down helicopters. Because we would now bring all our Marines aground and to do what we got to do. And so I think they just let us come in and get our Marines out, get the ambassador out, and then go home and get off their land, period. And so at that point, it's just a closure in that history, and it took another 20 years before another war came around. So,
well, again, we're going to have a chance to talk about the rest of your career the next time we get together. One other question here about, there are lots of stories in the Vietnam era about the way Vietnam veterans who came back to the United States were treated, and not very well, by the American public. Did you experience any of that?
I did not. I wasn't no happy welcome home signs, obviously, but I didn't catch the others. Now we didn't fly from coast to coast in uniforms either. At least I did, and most of the Marines I knew did not. Some of the troops did because we didn't fly that much, and I don't remember. I don't remember the airports I did fly into that I saw much of the anti-baby killer and all that stuff. I didn't see that. But then again, I wasn't at the hub of a lot of these Marine units coming back home either. Again, I flew to Pensacola, Florida, back from my next assignment, and I landed, and then met the wife, and she came down. And so it was a different area I was in that may have not been as anti-military to start with, or anti-Vietnam to start with. You get the West Coast, you got a lot of that, and a lot of that was experienced from a lot of the Marines and soldiers as well on the West Coast.
You've done a wonderful job, Gary, of laying all this out and painting some very vivid word pictures as we've gone through this as well. Wonder if you have any final comments about your experiences, especially the experiences you had in the evacuation of South Vietnam.
Well, I guess the final note would be that it's a part of our history that we obviously went through. It was amazing that we did have bigger plans to do this right, being getting everybody out with the big transports. But we had the foresight to see that this doesn't work. What are we going to have as a backup? And what was the backup plan behind that? I didn't get the third backup plan involved. I don't know what that would might have been if there was. But we did have a backup plan, and so from that standpoint. Historical that we lost an embassy in a country that we fought so hard and a lot of people died to protect. I may not agree with all the politics involved, but that's beside the point as a military person. You're assigned a mission, you go to execute. Yeah, there, you wish it could be done other ways. Stories, I had dinner with General Westmoreland and General Voigt in the War College later on, and they told some stories about what they experienced, that they couldn't do some things based on the politics and such, which was adds more insight to what was going on during the war itself. But I just hope we haven't got another war like that to go through, and hope we're smart enough politically to avoid it. But at the same time, I just hope the military forces are prepared to go do what they got to do if we get assigned.
Thank you very much, Gary.
You're welcome.